From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week came a moment many thought they'd never see. President Obama orders a return to full diplomatic relations with Cuba.
Isolation has not worked. It's time for a new approach.
Meanwhile, another one-time Cold War enemy stumbles. The Russian ruble falls, and President Vladimir Putin reacts.
Russia has indeed contributed to the tension that we are seeing in the world, but only in the sense that it's protecting its national interests more and more robustly.
And the hack heard from Hollywood to Washington. Sony pulls a movie from the theaters about an assassination plot against North Korea's leader, a comedy no less, because of escalating threats made by hackers. Movie makers and moviegoers are upset.
They got a lot of people scared, that's for sure. They got movie theaters scared to not show it. So as of right now, I think the hackers won without a doubt.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Brennan of CBS News, SV Date of NPR, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What's your top story this week? What's gotten your attention? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. So joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Margaret Brennan, State Department correspondent for CBS News. Margaret Brennan, it's good to have you here.
Hi, Michelle.
Also in Washington, D.C., SV Date joins us, editor at the Washington desk at NPR and a contributor to NPR's politics blog, author of the book Jeb, America's Next Bush. Sharice Date, hello, my hometown friend.
Hey there, Michelle. How are you?
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Michelle, Margaret, and SV.
All right. It's good to have you all here. Margaret, I'm going to start with you, and we want to talk about the Sony hack attack first. And I want to start by hearing White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest speaking yesterday. It seems that the White House is taking this very seriously now. Here it is.
This is something that's being treated as a serious national security matter. There is evidence to indicate that we have seen destructive activity with malicious intent that was initiated by a sophisticated actor.
So, Margaret, do I have this right? I mean, the language is obviously very important here. And in a moment like this, I'm assuming that the White House and the State Department, they weigh their words very carefully. But it seems that there's a hesitation to call this terrorism. Is there a reason for that? There's this hesitation to call this cyber terrorism. Why is that?
That's an interesting question. You're exactly right. Well, I think one of the unsaid things is that the U.S. has an offensive cyber program that we don't talk much about. And it gets you into interesting legal ground to start declaring offensive cyber attacks as terrorism, because what does that mean for some of what the United States has done? You've seen that reporting about some attacks on Iran and its nuclear program that have been blamed on the United States. So you get into these things that lawyers in the White House and State Department debate. But more directly here, while we have learned and CBS has reported out that the attack on Sony originated in North Korea and then was routed through other locations, there's a hesitation to lay blame directly, not only because of what I just said, but also there are some limited tools here. We don't have diplomatic relations with North Korea. If you have anything other than a quote-unquote proportional response, what does that mean to escalate tensions there? Do you actually make things worse by acknowledging what North Korea is doing here, because they do seem to be seeking attention in an effort, some would say, to bring the U.S. back to the negotiating table on the nuclear issue with them and perhaps give them some incentive to do that? But
well, thanks for raising one of the issues I wanted to hear from you anyway, which is that what is the range of options here? That's Jay Johnson, the Homeland Security Chief, said the U.S. is weighing a range of options. And you started to talk about that. Could you talk a little bit more about that? What is that range of options?
Well, one of the things is to put North Korea back on a terror blacklist. If you remember back in 2008, the Bush administration took them off that list. There are only four other countries on it, you know, Iran, Sudan, and Cuba right now. And you really get a new package of sanctions that would go along with that, more financial pain for North Korea. But that takes some time. So that's one diplomatic tool they could do. And there could be other things that basically the United States isn't going to acknowledge or say that they're attempting to do covertly.
Hmm. Sharice, would you pick up the thread there? Is there anything you want to add to that? I'm also interested in what's the temperature around this issue in Washington right now? There were, you know, at the beginning, as we've talked about, it was you know, it was a kind of a style section story, an entertainment division story about, you know, juicy bits from Hollywood. Interesting about the business and a business story about the corporate impact on Sony. And then with this specific, you know, threat of physical violence against people who show the film or are connected to the film, that becomes kind of a different issue. So what's the temperature around this issue in Washington, and how is it being seen?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, we started out with the idea that this was about a movie, a comedy, which may have been a really bad movie as far as we know, and based on at least the trailers. And yet now this has become a serious matter. Part of the problem, perhaps, is that it's also competing with Cuba at the same time. So there's a certain attention span issue as well. There's a lot of outrage in Congress right now about the decision by the president to reopen the diplomatic relations with Cuba. And so maybe we're not seeing quite the response to North Korea as we might otherwise.
Do you think, Shirish, forgive me, I'm asking you to kind of read tea leaves and temperature here a bit more, but is the threat of violence taken seriously? Is that seen to be a credible threat, or is that seen to be more of an attention-getting ploy?
I can't say for sure, but it does seem like it's more attention-getting. On the other hand, anytime there's a threat, how do you not take it seriously when people's lives are and safety is threatened by possibly another country?
Hmm. Now, of course, Hollywood has reacted fiercely to the cancellation of The Interview. Now, that's the movie that is said to have sparked all of this, and it's for people who haven't been following this. It's a film. It's a comedy. It's a broad comedy in the Seth Rogen manner that describes kind of a plot. He's playing James Franco plays a TV interview, and Seth Rogen plays his executive producer. And the plot is that they have been they are being induced by the CIA or asked by the CIA to use the pretext of an interview to assassinate North Korea's supreme leader. And a number of Hollywood celebrities have weighed in. And here's late night host Jimmy Kimmel.
Personally, I think allowing a ruthless dictator of another country to decide what American people can and cannot see in our own country is against, like, everything we're supposed to stand for, right? I mean, people die for it.
Jack Beatty, and forgive me, I was, you know, when I think of you, I think of Warren Beatty, so forgive me for messing up your name earlier. But, you know, here's my question. One of the leaked emails says that one of the finest actors of his generation, Denzel Washington, shouldn't get any more lead roles because supposedly racist people overseas won't want to see that. And it's been widely reported that Hollywood routinely chops up and makes edits to films for the Chinese market. So, you know, can somebody please tell me why it is that they're willing to appease people who have either kind of racist or cultural presumptions that are different than ours for commercial reasons, but they're crying foul when it's for this. Does that strike you at all?
Well, you know, sauce for the goose and the rest. I mean, effectively, the North Koreans have responded, if it is the North Koreans, have responded in the same way at the box office. You know, I really think our government may easily make too much of it. It is a comedy. It is a movie. It is American commerce. Usually we don't realign or make a foreign policy incident out of something that inconveniences one of our companies. Yes, it's the sacred right of free expression and all the rest. But eventually this will be seen. It's probably going to be seen very soon on you know, the streaming services. And it'll probably in some ways recoup for Sony and make a lot of money. I really think the government shouldn't overreact.
Let's take a couple of calls on this. Is it Marilyn? Marilyn, you're calling from Plattsmouth. Am I pronouncing this properly? Nebraska.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. What's your comment or thought? Welcome.
My comment, Michelle, is that I think the focus on this is so wrong. I think the focus should be on why the company was making a movie about assassinating a living person. To me, that doesn't even reach the lowest standards of good taste, good sense, morality, or ethics. I mean, you don't make movies about killing somebody else's leader, no matter who they are.
Hmm. Marilyn, thanks so much for calling. I think we may have a different view from Alfred, who's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Alfred, what's your comment about this?
Hi, Michelle. I'm actually very concerned about the censorship issue because I just think that we have a great tradition of satire in America, and I think art can send a powerful message that oftentimes, you know, it's hard to get out any other way. And I think that the, you know, the danger of corporations deciding, you know, what they're going to show based on some potential inflammatory material is a really dangerous precedent. And I'm an author myself, and I write satirical novels, and I often feel like satire has become much, you know, reduced in recent years because there is this fear of upsetting anyone. And I think that that's kind of the point. I mean, if you're not upsetting anyone, you're not really doing anything useful. And there's a danger to that.
Sharish, I'm going to ask you to respond to this because you are also an author in addition to, you know, you're a journalist. And I think you've also written some fiction, too. Do I have that right?
That's right.
And how do you react to this?
Well, I used to write satirical novels, and someday I might again. But the caller had an interesting point. I mean, I would never actually use a living person. In fact, most novels have at the start that this is all fiction and any resemblances are purely coincidental, etc. On the other hand, this is North Korea that everyone agrees has some horrible human rights violations. Is not a pleasant place because of its leadership. So I'm of mixed feelings here. On the one hand, I probably wouldn't have written anything about an actual human. But I can certainly see the point of not wanting to back down to a country that doesn't really share many of our values.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the weekend news with our roundtable, S.V. Date of NPR, Margaret Brennan of CBS News, and On Point's own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What do you think will come from more open relations with Cuba? How about that Jeb Bush? He's getting closer to committing to a run for the presidency in 2016. Margaret, let's turn to that big news about Cuba. Here's President Obama on Wednesday on ABC News, and he said that the change in Cuba will come, but it will have less to do with the Castro brothers and much more to do with the younger generation of Cubans. Here he is.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that, you know, Raul Castro at the age of 80-something is going to be changing significantly. But there's going to be generational change in Cuba. This last conversation was substantive. I was very insistent with him that we would continue to promote democracy and human rights and speak out forcefully on behalf of the freedom of the people of Cuba.
So, Margaret, just to review for people who may not have followed the story closely, what's changed and what isn't changing?
Well, nothing changed overnight. This is going to take days and weeks to implement, according to the State Department. But it is a huge announcement by the United States that they're going to restore diplomatic relations. And what it means up front is that the U.S. is going to start directly dealing with and talking to Cuban officials about all the things that they are already concerned about in terms of human rights abuses and the like. But for everyone in America, Cuban Americans in particular, it will make it a bit easier for you to transfer money, for you to engage with Cuba. For Cubans, particularly small business owners, there may be a big boom here, and the business community in both countries may actually be the biggest beneficiary.
And what was Pope Francis's role, Margaret?
Well, the Vatican was a really important diplomatic channel here. Both the president and Secretary Kerry dealt with the Pope and some of his top diplomats to get these talks going. Remember, Cuba is primarily a Catholic country, and the Pope has wanted to broker a, I guess, detente here between the U.S. and Cuba. And he really does have great reach and influence there. So there was an exchange of letters. There was an exchange of direct sort of guarantee by the Pope that these talks are legitimate. This isn't going to be a waste of your time. Keep going. And over 18 months, they actually came to an agreement on Tuesday with that 45-minute phone call between Raul Castro and President Obama.
Can I just ask you briefly, Margaret? I know we've this may not be a language that people are used to using here, but we've talked about what the U.S. interest is. We've talked about the Cuban interest. What was Pope Francis's interest in this, in playing this kind of active role? Was it primarily humanitarian, the impact of keeping families apart? Why did he choose to play such an important role in this?
Well, he has wanted to sort of broker peace here. That's what he has described it as during homilies in the past week. But really, I mean, remember where he's from. Remember what his roots are. He's very much described himself as a man of the people. He's from Latin America. And I think maybe Americans don't realize how much the U.S.-Cuba tension and policy has influenced the view of the U.S. in South America, in Central America. And in many ways, unfreezing that relationship with Cuba may change the dynamic that the U.S. has with countries like Venezuela, which has been a hostile relationship, with Brazil, which has been tense recently. So this goes far beyond just the small island 90 miles off the U.S. shore. This could have greater influence for U.S. policy in Latin America, and the Pope helped broker that.
Charisse, let's turn to you. I'm not sure if everybody remembers that you actually spent quite a lot of time reporting in Florida, and this issue has been a big part of Florida politics, you know, for many years now. I'm sure you weren't surprised by some of the pushback to this. Let's just hear a little bit. This is Congresswoman Ileana Ros-Lehtinen. She's Republican from Florida. She spoke to Fox News on Wednesday, and she talked about why she is against normalizing relations with Cuba.
What is sad is that tomorrow the Cuban people will wake up and they will still have no political freedom. They will have no human rights to be respected. There are no political parties that exist in Cuba. That has not changed. Obama has given away the store, has given everything to the Castro regime. Of course, the regime is happy. We got nothing in return.
Charisse, let me ask you this. Some of this is like a play that we've seen before, where everybody's kind of playing out their role, saying what we expect them to say. Was there anything about the reaction that did not conform to that previous script? And I just want to mention, I realize this is not scientific, but in the calls that we received on this when we've been reporting on this, they were overwhelmingly positive, which is really unusual. People generally kind of, you know, are pretty evenly divided, and overwhelmingly people were supportive of what the president did. Recognizing that's not scientific, but I wanted to know what you're seeing and hearing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's funny that in Florida, for the decades that I was down there, the elections, all elections that were statewide, had a Cuba component, and people in Miami, regardless of the office, would say, you know, and Castro must go. And it was almost understood in the rest of the state that's the kind of stuff you have to say down there in order to connect with that community. And what's amazing is that President Obama was able to possibly have won, based on exit polling, the Cuban-American vote in 2012, despite having said before the 2008 election that he wanted to open up, you know, relationships with Cuba. So a couple of things have happened. One is that just as the Castro brothers are in their 80s, so are a lot of the people who left Cuba very early on in the 1960s. So there's a big generational gap here. The people who were born in the States particularly, and maybe now in the third generation, they aren't as vociferously anti-Castro as their parents and grandparents. And second, used to be Cuban Americans were the biggest Hispanic group in Florida. That's not the case anymore, by far.
That's interesting. Jack, what's the best comparison here? When you think about this story, is there an analogy that comes to mind for you? Is it China, Vietnam?
Well, you know, when he was asked how he'd end communism in the Soviet Union, FDR said he'd mail the Sears Roebuck catalog to every Russian household. You know, that's one way to achieve regime change. Another is to do what the U.S. has done with Cuba over the last 50 years, embargo shipment of the Sears Roebuck catalog to the Cuban people. Meanwhile, of course, the CIA toyed with change on the quick schemes like killing Fidel Castro with an exploding seashell. President Obama has a different idea. He wants to set American tourists with their iPhone access to consumer Valhalla loose on and let what Adam Smith called the desire of every man to better his condition do the rest. Over the long run, as China's rulers may discover, there's just no resisting the power of capitalism.
But stay on that point for a minute, that analogy for a minute. And we are going to take some calls in a minute. But look, China, I don't think anybody thinks that, you know, China obviously has a very robust economic system and very robust economic ties with the U.S. and in other countries right now. But it is not a free society. I don't think anybody thinks that that's true. So where is the evidence that just having these strong economic ties necessarily leads to democratic freedom?
Well, feudalism doesn't exist anymore, and one of the reasons is the mercantile revolution and capitalism. Totalitarianism in most of the world doesn't exist anymore, and I think the Sears Roebuck catalog is as much responsible for that as the U.S. defense budget. Karl Marx summed up what we're talking about here, the power we're talking about, when he said, "All that is solid melts into air." That's what economic forces do. That's what self-interest does. That's what it has done historically. Okay. China's been on this bat now for, what, 35, 40 years? Mm-hmm. Give it some more time, and let's see what change happens.
All right, let's hear some calls. Eric is calling from St. Louis, Missouri. Eric, what's your comment or question? Welcome.
Hi, Michelle. It's good to hear your voice again. I've missed you over the past few months.
Well, thank you.
A couple of things. I just want to make two points. I'll be brief. Point number one, the Republican lawmaker that just said that America didn't get anything out of this, I can tell you right now that there are, between Walmart, Coca-Cola, and Exxon, and every company in between, they're licking their chops right now and biding their time before those markets begin to open up. The second point I want to make is that the Republican Party and the media, who sometimes marches in lockstep with the Republican Party, has done such a good job in maligning Barack Obama that we don't realize what a truly revolutionary figure we have in real time in the Oval Office right now. Here's a man who doesn't, who understands the futility of war. He's ended the two war, Iraq and Afghanistan. He understands that arming rebel groups in various conflicts in the Middle East is foolishness, because every time we do it, the guns end up being turned on us eventually. Of course, he lost out because of tremendous political pressure on that one in regards to Syria. And then here he is now in Cuba, turning back the clock to mistakes made all the way back by JFK 50 years ago. I mean, it's just, I don't think Barack Obama gets the credit he deserves, and I don't understand why. Thank you for taking my call.
All right, thanks. Interesting point. I'm going to ask Sharish to take that in just a second, but I want to hear one more call. Jim is calling from Ohio. Jim?
Yes, I'm in favor of Barack's move on Cuba. But I also wanted to comment on the North Korean story, that it seems to me that it could be a publicity stunt engineered by Sony itself to get it in the news, and everybody's talking about this movie now, and they're going to go see it. But
I don't know. That seems kind of, forgive me, Jim, I don't want to argue with you, but it just seems like putting your employees' social security numbers online and the pseudonyms or the aliases that they use to check into hotels, which opens up all kinds of security safety questions for them. I don't know.
I might be wrong, Michelle, but I think it'll turn out that Sony engineered this whole fiasco. But as far as Cuba goes, I mean, if you compare Cuba to any other country south of our border, including Mexico, I mean, the people there are so much better off, and I don't know why we've been maligning them and demonizing Castro and all this hate that's been going from our country to theirs. When you have in Mexico police with coming in and killing college students and for our drug lords. I mean, that sort of thing doesn't happen in Cuba. There's no death squads like in El Salvador, Guatemala, and stuff like that.
Well,
I mean, Cuba is paradise compared to Haiti or any other country south of our border.
Okay. Well, I'm sure there were a lot of people who will argue with you, but we'll have to take that one offline. So thank you for calling, Jim. So, Charisse, let's go back to the question that Eric raised earlier, that this, you know, he says that you know, just last summer, and certainly after the midterm elections, people were saying that, you know, Obama, lame duck, getting nothing, was not going to really be able to do anything except, you know, count the days down until he ends his term. And that seems to have changed, or has that perception changed? Have these recent moves, I mean, this executive action on immigration, and then this move, and then, of course, you know, the Russian economy in such difficulty, do you think that that's changing the perception of Obama and what he's able to accomplish in his final days in office?
Right. I think that's a very good point. And I think some polls are starting to bear that out. As the economy improves and as the election is kind of behind us, people are starting to have a more favorable view of the president. It's interesting that these are the sort of things that he said he was going to do before he ran the first time. And finally now feels liberated after the last midterm election in his second term. Now he's going to do all those things unconstrained. by the Democrats in Congress who don't want to do things for fear of losing seats and so on. So maybe that's what you get in two terms. You can do stuff in your first year of your first term, and then you can do things in your last 2 years of your second term. Maybe that's what we're down to. And can I point out, by the way, that earlier caller did say that the mainstream media is in lockstep with the Republican Party. I just want to point that out. There's one person in America, at least, who believes that. So
okay, well, I got to pick your brain on Florida for just one more second, Sharish, which is the Jeb Bush's announcement. I don't know if you, I guess it was an announcement that he's thinking about running for president. You covered him for a long time and you followed his career and you wrote a book about him, Jeb, America's Next Bush. So I'd like to ask how you interpret what he said. Do you think that that means that he's definitely in, and what do you think his chances are, as briefly as you can?
Right. I would say that Jeb has been running for president for, is he 61 years old now? So he's been running for about 55 years. And I don't know that he ever really stopped. He's very determined once he sets on a course. And I would have been surprised if he hadn't have put out some message out here, in maybe not necessarily this week, but in certainly by the end of this year, to kind of freeze out some of the money that otherwise might have started to go to other people. That was an important thing for him to do.
Makes perfect sense. Well, thanks for that. Margaret, before we end the segment, we need to take a short break in just a minute, but I do want to ask you about Russia. With all of the big international news this week, it's almost like this almost escaped our attention, but Putin gave his big end-of-the-year press conference in the shadow of enormous economic troubles, including a sinking ruble. This is what he said. Mm-hmm.
I said that under the most unfavorable conditions of the foreign economy, this situation could continue. Approximately, nobody can say exactly, for 2 years. But that does not have to be like that. The situation can improve sooner.
Margaret, what has led to these circumstances? Is it mainly sinking oil prices? Is it sanctions from their incursions into Ukrainian territory? What's going on here?
Well, the U.S. strategy has been to sort of pour salt on an open wound, which is you've already got a sinking oil price that's hurting the Russian economy. They've had some issues economically. Now, with all these sanctions that the U.S. and Europe have leveraged against it because of what Russia's doing in Ukraine, they're going to have more problems financing their debt potentially here. You've seen their currency in decline. So it's really a number of factors. But what we know is that President Obama has pledged today to sign into law more sanctions. They're not going to hit right away. He's giving himself more options to slap them once again. But this is sort of a diplomatic good cop, bad cop. They're trying to force Russia to comply with a ceasefire agreement they signed to pull back a bit from Ukraine. So it's really that incursion, which, by the way, sanctions are hurting Russia, but they haven't really forced it to change its policy. They still have annexed all that land in Crimea. So that's where we are right now. It's sort of this diplomatic standoff to see if all this financial pain can be withstood by Putin, or is the U.S. providing a useful enemy because the sanctions can be blamed for what is already an existing problem in Russia?
As briefly as you can and as well as you can determine, do you feel that Putin's standing in Russia has been affected by all of this?
Well, in some way, that's why the U.S. and Europe are showing themselves to be useful enemies, because by hitting this nationalistic tone, even though there's all this financial pain, Putin's popularity has been on the rise. So to claim this very nationalistic tone of saying, you know, Ukraine is part of our historical identity, and to hit a lot of these really some would say, you know, controversial tones, it's actually helping boost him politically, even though his people are hurting more financially and economically.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, on C-SPAN, pundits and brothers Brad and Dallas Woodhouse got a surprise viewer call. It was Mom.
You're right. I'm from down south.
Oh, God, it's Mom.
And I'm your mother. And I disagree that all families are like ours. I don't know many families that are fighting at Thanksgiving.
The popular Whodunit podcast Serial ended yesterday.
So you don't really have, if you don't mind me asking, you don't really have no ending? Like, it's just...
I mean, do I have an ending?
And the last episode of The Colbert Report aired last night. Stephen Colbert takes over for David Letterman.
Folks, if this is your first time tuning into The Colbert Report, I have some terrible news. This, in fact, is your last time tuning into The Colbert Report.
You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What story has flown under the radar, perhaps, that got your attention? Margaret, before we move to some more domestic news, I don't want to skip past what happened in Pakistan, that terrible attack on a school in Peshawar, which killed more than 130 children. I just want to hear the voice of one of the students who survived. This is Akif Azim. He was taking an exam at the time of the attack, and he told the BBC that he wants to go back to school.
I want to go in. I want to enter those classrooms. I want to enter that auditorium where we used to sit and we used to, you know, study. We are still up. They cannot defeat us. We are still up.
So Margaret, just tell us if there's anything that we've learned about this or what you would like us to be thinking about this story at this point.
I mean, beyond the horror of attacking children for political gain, what we know is that the Taliban in Pakistan claims that they carried out this attack. And it really gets to the fight internally in Pakistan right now for who controls those tribal areas along the border with Afghanistan. And we are going to hear a lot more about horrible attacks like this. We know the Taliban in Afghanistan has threatened to increase their attacks on U.S. aid workers, on civilians who are there trying to help the local communities as international troops withdraw from Afghanistan, as the U.S. draws down and as NATO draws down. So civilians, and unfortunately, as we saw this week, tragically, students are now targets in this war for control of those areas. The war is not over.
That's Margaret Brennan, State Department correspondent for CBS News. Also with us, S.V. Date, editor at the Washington desk at NPR and contributor to NPR's politics blog, and our own Jack Beatty. So, Jack, Governor Cuomo announced Wednesday that he would ban hydraulic fracking. This is Andrew Cuomo, the Democratic governor of New York, and he said that he is not qualified to make this decision by himself, but here he is.
I'm a lawyer. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an environmentalist. I'm not a scientist. So let's bring the emotion down and let's ask the qualified experts what their opinion is.
So, Jack, tell me about this. How do you understand this this decision? I have to mention that this was something that a part of New York that has really, you know, suffered economically. It's my understanding that people who live in that part of the state were really, you know, hoping that this would be approved. There's been a moratorium, you know, on fracking because they really feel that they need that economic that boost, and they're very disappointed. How do you understand this decision? Do you think this is not that the politics of this is preeminent, the substance is important, but politically, how do you think this cuts for the governor?
Well, the governor says he's not a scientist. He is a politician, however, and as the Times pointed out, he has put off making a decision on this, so they see over a couple of years, essentially, basically saying, well, we're going to have the scientists decide. And he didn't, the scientists just coincidentally didn't decide until after the election. So the people in the affected counties didn't get to find out where the governor was going to come down on this. You know, it's an important move, obviously. His science advisor, Dr. Howard Zucker, said, would I live in a community with fracking based on the facts that I have now? Would I let my child play in the school field? My answer is no. Well, okay, that's his answer. But, you know, sort of taking the substance out of elections by saying, well, we'll have the commission decide after, it kind of takes some of the substance out of democracy. We've just had something similar here in Vermont. Peter Shumlin, the governor, committed as long ago as 3 years ago to a single payer in Vermont. It was supposed to start in 2013. Supposed to tell us how it was going to be paid for. Put off. Finally, there was an election in November. He just squeaked by. And now, gee, wouldn't you know it, the study came out and it said we can't afford it. That is, Vermonters can't afford it. Well, maybe if the governor had told the people before the election might have more meaning.
Okay. Sharish, has there been a response to this in Washington?
To what the governor?
The fracking,
of
yes, it's a fracking decision.
You know, right, but it's kind of that particular thing is a is a state concern. Fracking generally has been pretty popular because it brings jobs and it brings, therefore, a lot of money to those states. It's a little bit easier to do what Governor Cuomo did when oil prices are dropping like they have been than perhaps if they were still up over $100 a barrel.
We've been talking about Jeb Bush's thinking about making a presidential run in 2016. What about Andrew Cuomo?
Well, there's this other Democratic candidate that everyone's talking about named Hillary Clinton.
With a New York connection.
Right.
Former senator.
I suppose anything can happen. And it is important to remember that it is still 2014, and we still have a year before the Iowa caucuses. And if you look back as to where polling was in even early 2011, you don't really have a good sense of how things are going to play out over that coming year. That said, Jeb Bush has said he's going to be for an all-in energy policy that includes as much domestic oil production as possible, which I will point out is somewhat of a change from back when he was governor of Florida and wanted very much to protect the shoreline down there from offshore oil drilling.
I think Danielle has something to say about this. Danielle is calling from Woodward, Iowa. Danielle, what's your comment or question? Welcome.
Thanks, Michelle. As far as fracking goes, I think Governor Cuomo made the right decision. He went above politics, and he invoked what's called the precautionary principle, that if there is evidence of harm or potential harm, you seek alternative solutions. Carolyn Raffensperger is the author of that precautionary principle. We need to invoke it more and not less.
Hmm. Do you feel, Jack, that environmental policy... it's interesting. It's like a number of other issues, terribly important to some people, a priority for some people. But I don't know. Is there evidence that enough people vote on the environment per se that it becomes a defining issue? What's your perspective on that?
Well, the Times points out that he had a, quote, surprisingly contentious reelection campaign, his primary, because his opponent, Zephyr Teachout, opposed fracking and did very well for someone with no money. And he clearly must have got some message from that about what was popular in the state as a whole. It's just very difficult for the people who live in these counties adjoining Pennsylvania, live on top of the Marcellus Shale, and they can't, they've not only lost this as a possible economic elixir for their really dormant area, but they've also lost casino gambling. The governor, at the same time, another commission came out and said, yeah, we want to have casinos, but just not around Binghamton. Mm. Tough for those folks.
Very tough. Very tough. So let's spend a little time talking about the Congress and the Senate and what they did and didn't do. Sharice, the Senate passed the finalized $1.1 trillion spending bill on Saturday. The president has signed it. What can you just tell us about this process? Is there anything that's in the bill that surprises you? Is there anything that we can kind of learn from just how this whole thing actually ensued? Or are we ever going to get back to kind of a normal budgeting process where, you know, committees take up issues, they discuss it, pass a bill, or is it
right.
just
it,
a hot mess the, once again?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is and it isn't, I guess. I'll make this analogy. If you've got a couple of teenagers and you instruct them to clean the room, if one of them has a philosophical objection to having a clean room, guess what? The room's not going to get clean. And that's kind of what we have in Congress. We have a group of folks who honestly believe that we have too many regulations, too many laws. And so they go about in the House passing laws that undo a bunch of those regulations. And then the Senate doesn't pass them because that was controlled by Democrats. Well, the new Congress will be all Republicans, so maybe we'll see some change in terms of being a do-nothing Congress, as it's been called. On the other hand, what had to get passed, which is the spending bill to keep the government going for the next year, it got passed. There was a couple of things in there that almost made it not pass. There are a couple of provisions. One had to do with campaign finance. It allows parties to raise a lot more money from single donors, almost $1 million a year now rather than less than $100,000. And the other thing had to do with unrolling some of the rules on banks from the Dodd-Frank law. Because of that, there was a fair amount of opposition from Democrats who otherwise might have said, this is something we can live with. It's not a great funding bill, but it's better than the one we're going to get next year. Mm. These two provisions almost sank it in the House.
Margaret, speaking of, you know, of opposition, when the Republicans control both houses starting in January, a number of issues that they've already expressed a lot of disagreement with the president on in the foreign policy sphere. We know his executive action on immigration, and we just talked about Cuba. What are the chances that the Republican Congress will undo some of these initiatives that the president has started?
Well, what they can do could be disruptive, but they can't really stop the president from restoring diplomatic relations with Cuba. Right now, we know in the next 6 months, the president told the State Department, you have to tell us whether or not Cuba's a state sponsor of terrorism. We'll lift some sanctions. Congress can't stop that. Congress gets 45 days heads up, but they can't block it from happening. What they can do is refuse to pull back the embargo, which means tourists won't be able to go, which means you won't be able to bring in Cuban cigars and sell them to your friends.
Now you tell me.
But what they also could disrupt is the diplomacy underway with Iran. Remember, in March, we have a big deadline coming up to really sort of put all the cards on the table and see whether it's possible to move forward in negotiations on a nuclear deal. And Congress and the threats to come in and put more sanctions on Iran really could change the dynamic and really could make it a lot harder for the Iranians to trust U.S. negotiators in offering more concessions here. So Congress has some cards, but they can't stop the diplomacy that the president's already started.
I think we have time for one more call. Let's hear from Christine, who's calling from Blacksburg, South Carolina. Christine, welcome.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for taking my call. Kind of switching gears just a little bit. I've been listening to your wonderful show, and I'm so proud of Cuomo and what he said. I'm also very, very proud of our president for opening up the doors for diplomacy with Cuba. My main focus was I just want to see term limits in the Congress, and I want to see more ladies. I don't want to see gray-haired men in three-piece suits telling me or my sisters or my mother what to do with our bodies. Bring on the ladies. We have a different outlook on things, and I would so love to see Jeb Bush run against Hillary Clinton. I think she would absolutely eat him up.
Okay. Well, Sharice, you know, there is a record number of, there will be a record number of women serving in the Congress come January. Will there not?
Right. That is true. In terms of term limits, though, like the caller asked about, that would require a constitutional change, and I just don't see that happening. In terms of a lot of the laws she was talking about, the legislation that deals with women's health issues, that comes from the states. And one of the things that happened in this midterm election was that many, many state houses went to the Republicans. And so that's not really a congressional thing, but there will be a lot more laws probably from a lot of the state houses in the next year or two.
Jack, can you give us a final thought about what is your sense of the new Congress and whether they will prioritize these international issues? They're squawking about them now, and I don't mean that in a demeaning way. They're expressing a lot of opposition to some of the president's moves at the end of the year. What's your sense of what's going to happen in the coming year?
Well, I think Ron Elving of NPR summed up the Republican dilemma very well the day after the election, the morning after, when he said they really want to do two things. And the two things are somewhat in tension. Number one, they want to have a record. They want to be able to go to the voters in 2016 and say, look, we're not the party of no. We got things done when we had the power. They want to do that. But they also, secondly, want to, you know, essentially give their base what the base wants, which is to defy at all cost and at all places President Obama. Those two things are in tension. We'll have to see which wins out.
Sharice, I think we have a time for a final thought from you as well.
Right. And that's an interesting point because the House, that's what the House has been doing for the last 3 years under Republican leadership since Speaker Boehner took over, was to try to defy the president when possible. Mitch McConnell, the incoming majority leader of the Senate, has kind of a different problem. He has a map going into 2016 that's about as difficult as the Democrats had going into this midterm. So he's got to be careful that they don't try to overreach, or that he may end up being a one-term majority leader, which obviously he does not want to do.
Margaret, final thought from you. What do you think is going to dominate your time in the coming year?
Oh, geez. I'm just hoping that the next 2 weeks of 2014 don't bring any more big diplomatic surprises. It has been a heck of a year for diplomacy. I think 2015, one thing to have on your radar is the competition in the Arctic, land grabs, Russia, Norway, other countries. And the U.S. is going to be pushing a lot on that because they take over the Arctic Council in 2015.
Margaret Brennan, State Department correspondent for CBS News. Goodbye, Margaret. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Esfi Date is editor at the Washington desk at NPR and contributor to NPR's politics blog. Esfi, thank you so much as well.
You're very welcome.
And On Point analyst Jack Beattie. Jack, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, a weak ruble and a turbulent economy. We look at Putin's Russia and what its economic freefall means. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.